From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. First of all, we should say most people agree Bram Stoker's novel Dracula was no masterpiece. He had the basic problems: slow pace, implausible plot points, too much moralizing. The historian Jim Steinmeier himself calls it odd and clunky. But there's got to be a reason why the story has survived for so long, why audiences continue to be drawn to it. Well, Steinmeier says there are good reasons, reasons he'll explain today, but here's a big one, maybe even the main reason it works. It's not the creepy undead stuff, it's the weird sexual energy. Jim Steinmeier has been asking himself, who was Dracula? It's the name of his book. And today in the program, he'll join us to explain what he found after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. You can do that online at KUER.org. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When Bram Stoker published his novel Dracula in 1897, it wasn't the first story about a vampire. In fact, they were all over the place, in books, in the papers, and, of course, on the stage. Stoker was a man of the theater, so he would have seen his share, but the historian Jim Steinmeier says it was the people that Stoker encountered in the theater, as much as the stories on the stage, that influenced his creation of Dracula. Steinmeier's written a book called Who Was Dracula, where he explores what inspired the character, and he says it was a pastiche of people, fascinating people. We're talking Oscar Wilde and Walt Whitman and maybe even Jack the Ripper. Yes, Bram Stoker may have had dinner with Jack the Ripper. We'll get to that story later today. Today in the program, we're talking about Bram Stoker's Dracula, and you can join us if you like. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Jim Steinmeier is an historian. He's a magician, a designer of illusions, by the way. They've been used by Doug Henning and David Copperfield and Siegfried and Roy and many others. He has a number of books on magic. The book we're talking about today is Who Was Dracula? Bram Stoker's Trail of Blood. And he's joining us today from Southern California Public Radio in Pasadena. Jim Steinmeier, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Doug. It's great to be here.
Well, I guess I wanted to start with something I had read. You mentioned very early on in the book that Dracula was the first adult novel that you ever read.
Yeah, that's my little guilty confession about this book. When I was in fourth grade, I was convinced to read Dracula by a schoolmate, a friend of mine who said that he had read it. Actually, he hadn't read it. But it made me go to the adult section of the local library, and it made me check out the book, and it made me sit and suffer through this incredibly dull, long, seemed to me at the time, incredibly long, because it had no pictures, of course, Victorian novel and Victorian sensibilities. And I would say I was rewarded by the end of it, yes.
Yeah. But it's interesting because your friend said that he admitted to you later he'd only read the beginning and the end.
Yes, that's right.
And this is the thing that you say is sort of... that kind of happens to a lot of people, that a lot of people really only know the beginning and the end, because most leave out a lot of the story when they recreate the films on stage or the things that we've seen. And you say that most of us don't really know the actual story or most of the story.
I think that Bram Stoker's creation is a real surprise to people. And is more of a surprise when you think you're familiar with the Dracula story. Mm-hmm. Because the book has its own sensibility, its own pace, its own characters. I know there was a Coppola film that endeavored to bring the book to the screen. But that was not any less a fiction than any of the other Dracula incarnations. Right. And Stoker had a particular way of telling it. He was coming at it from a particular sensibility. It's a very strange blend of modern and old-fashioned in novel, in storytelling, in characters. And I think that all of that contributes to the dynamic attitude of this book, why we kind of scratch our head over it, and why it continues to intrigue us generation after generation.
Well, I want to break that down as we go along. You say up front in the book, we should pity poor Bram Stoker in some ways. He's this proper Irishman, this careful Victorian. He writes this book that becomes a phenomenon, really, creates a character, as you say, more interesting that than he was.
Yes.
What do you mean?
Well, he never understood the success of Dracula.
Yeah.
He certainly understood that it was his most successful book, but he died before it became a sensation, and it was merely his most successful novel of a number of kind of lackluster novels during his lifetime. And the character was so intriguing and so mysterious that it forced generations of readers to start puzzling back over Bram Stoker, who doesn't provide the clues within his life, doesn't provide the obvious clues of where this character came from. There's a strange thing that happens in Dracula, which is that when you look at Stoker, as his contemporaries looked at him, he was something of a plotter. He was, meaning he was kind of a steady worker in the employ of Henry Irving, managing his theater. He wasn't a creative force. He wasn't known for his creativity or for his inventiveness or for his storytelling. He was known as the man who took care of the schedules and the budgets for the Lyceum Theater and got all the heavy lifting done. And his contemporaries were kind of puzzled by his ability to write this book and didn't really know where it came from. And I think that we continue that today as we look at it. It seems to come out of nowhere. And I think that's part of the intrigue is that much of this seems to come out of a subconscious understanding and his ability to put pieces of a story together that he might not even have been aware of where they were coming from within his lifetime. So the character of Dracula is infinitely more interesting than Stoker himself, and as people look back at Stoker and try to provide explanations for this, there have been a lot of mysterious things ascribed to him in terms of his private life and his sexuality and his secret desires, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't know that really that's a fair thing to do, but I do think that it's easy and interesting and absolutely rewarding to look at the situations that he was involved in and the characters he knew. And as I say, you know, we might ask, is it possible that these situations and characters had worked their way into Dracula? And I think when you look at it, you have to say, is it possible that they didn't work their way into
right.
this book?
Right.
Because he was in the middle of a number of really important controversies.
Well, it's interesting. A man such as yourself who writes about magic, who crafts illusions, what was the connection to this story of Dracula? I mean, in many ways, Stoker himself is a man of the theater. Was that the connection for you?
I would say it's really interesting. I would say that was the thing that where it suddenly snapped and made it work for me.
Huh.
I was a fan of the books and movies, and as I said to you, I'd read Dracula as a boy and was always intrigued by it. But I think that when I actually started looking at Stoker, and I had read several biographies of him over the years, when I really understood that not only was he a man of the theater, a man who was dealing with this every day, but that's really where this story is coming from. That's the motivating force behind the novel. That's the motivating force behind the characters. Suddenly, it made it real to me. I understood on some level where how he was crafting the story and putting it together. And I think that's the thing that we don't understand today, and I think that was the story that was worth telling, was that this was an incredibly theatrical story, even if during his lifetime it never made it onto the stage, which was one of his personal frustrations. It was a story designed out of theatricality that came out of his theatrical lifestyle and his theatrical associates. And so it's not a surprise that you know it was obviously destined to be carried forward in popular culture.
I'm trying to imagine the setting. Like, it would have been so great to be at one of these dinners at the Beefsteak Room, which is this private dining club of the Lyceum. I mean, imagine what the evenings must have been like and the stories and the characters and the stories that they must have told. Because this is sort of what you're talking about in terms of what must have influenced him at some point.
It's really hard because it's hard to evoke in terms of a book, because this is an era and a kind of association in terms of the theatrical profession that's completely gone today. Mm-hmm. The actor manager, the actor manager, Henry Irving,
yeah.
who was England's great, great star and Stoker's boss. And Irving was a superstar. He was the first actor in Great Britain who was knighted by Queen Victoria. And managed the Lyceum Theatre and, of course, was highly influential in terms of what he was putting on the stage. And he had a knack for playing these larger-than-life characters, these kind of supernatural characters, both on stage and off stage. And you refer to the Beefsteak Room. Within the theatre, there was a small dining room that yeah. they rediscovered and dusted off and restored. And they often hosted special guests at the Beefsteak Room after the performances. And Irving would arrive, sometimes having changed out of costumes and sometimes not having changed out of costume, and would then preside over these dinners where Stoker was there. And certainly, we know that a number of guests at the dinner, like a man named Augustus Vambury, who was familiar with Transylvania, talked about Transylvania at the dinners and would have been a strong influence as Bram Stoker was just beginning to outline his novel. And we know that the setting of Dracula changed in the outline shortly after that dinner with Vambury. So he was being influenced by a number of important people who came to the Lyceum, came to bask in the glow of Henry Irving, and then had these fascinating dinner talks afterwards.
I read there's this enticing story you tell in the acknowledgments that... Was it Orson Welles who first told you he thought Dracula was based on Henry Irving?
The first person I heard that from was Orson Welles.
That's so
and
great.
I worked with Orson Welles, and I know now where he got the story.
Huh.
I believe he actually read it in the newspaper when he was a boy. Hmm. He might have later met people who, it's possible, the years are right, he might have later met people in the UK who would have known Stoker and would have known Irving. This is a sort of delicious story that's cropped up, certainly after Welles told it to me. And it's a great story. It's kind of that, you know, oppressed worker story that...
Yeah.
The people who knew Stoker and knew Irving certainly understood that Bram Stoker was put upon all through his career. Irving demanded his presence for long, long hours. The shows went till late at night. Then there were these long dinners. Stoker never had the proper time to spend with his wife and his family. And he was the long-suffering employee. And I think that the way that some people have told that story with a kind of wonderful punchline is that, you know, he turned his boss into a blood-sucking vampire.
Right.
And, you know, that's what we all want to be able to do. But it's a great story, but it doesn't actually match the incidents. It's a little more complicated than that. And I think the easy way to say it and the easy way to translate it is that he did create a character that was supposed to be played by Henry Irving.
Mm-hmm.
He created a character that I don't think was modeled after Henry Irving, but was modeled after Henry Irving's roles. And I think the secret is that he desperately wanted Dracula to be put on stage by his boss, and that to some extent that's why the novel was written.
Yeah.
And it was an unbelievable missed opportunity by Henry Irving.
Hmm. Yeah, it was, really, when you think about it. We should just, you come out and say it, Dracula, it's not a great novel, as I mentioned in the introduction, you point this out, number of different reasons for all of that, but you say that there are these moments when the book really has this powerful effect, and I wanted to talk to you about one that you write about. There's this moment when a scene that really stops the book cold. This is the scene where Dracula is forcing the character of Wilhelmina, of Mina, to drink his blood, which is unexpected, as you say, really horrific. And you write this in your book. You say that the stodgy Victorian novel seems to momentarily collapse under the weight of this bizarre terror. Now, talk about why this is such a sort of a critical moment in this story.
It's really interesting because as I was writing this book, and I started talking to people, and many, many people have read Dracula, and you know, kind of forgotten big chunks of it. But I realized in talking to people that this was the scene that it was all revolving around to them. A number of people quoted this back to me quite distinctly, and it's the thing that always comes out of nowhere and surprises people. It's the thing that despite this being a kind of stodgy Victorian novel, it's written late in the Victorian era, but Stoker is mimicking all of the Victorian traditions in this novel. And so it comes across as kind of dull and character-driven and talky and obsessive about philosophy. And then suddenly, two-thirds of the way through this book, there's this very strange sexual scene in which Dracula appears, and he's been gone for a long time in this book. Yeah. He appears in the bedroom of the newlyweds. And as the vampire hunters invade the room, they find Dracula forcing Mina to drink his blood from an open vein in his chest. And that is the event that then triggers the remainder of this book, which is a kind of mad chase, a kind of Western, almost Western chase, yeah, back to Transylvania to destroy him and save Mina. Because that's also where it's apparent that this kind of wonderful, this amazing construction of Stoker's. And although I'm critical of the book, I have to give Stoker a lot of credit, of course, for these incredible creations, and one of which is his rules for the vampire, yeah, which is what we've studied today and what have worked into all of our books. That's completely the work of Bram Stoker. And one of the most important rules, and I think one of the most telling rules about who he was dealing with and the controversies, is this rule that if the person dies while they are under this infection, then that person becomes a vampire. And it's the thing that was never formalized in any other books or writings, and it's the step that really changes the story. We can't just have Dracula go away anymore. It's the reason that we have to actually chase him back and put an end to all of this. And it changes the tone of the novel completely. And also it gives this kind of theme to it, which is quite telling and quite interesting, of a kind of contagion and infection that's now roaring through society because of this foreigner, because of this outsider who's presented this.
It gives a vampire something more complicated. It gives him his nature, I guess.
Gives him his nature, and it gives him a staying power. In other words, it's not just about him. We understand that vampirism will go on and on and on, and we have to take care of this in a very specific way in order to prevent it. And all of this comes out of this one scene, which again happens at a spot in the book where we've sort of been lulled into a sort of submission about how this story is going to be told. And ironically, it's the scene that no one could deal with for many years. It's the scene that didn't make its way into the play. It's the story. It's the scene that didn't make its way into most of the early movies, because it's much too suggestive. It's much too graphic, and it's something that audiences were not able to deal with for a long time.
But is it the sex? The sex part, is that the reason it became such a phenomenon in its time?
Dracula, I mean, we just have to be honest about it. Dracula is a way of disenfranchised people to talk about sex when they're not supposed to be talking about sex.
Right.
And that's what the vampire is. It creates analogies for sex for people who weren't supposed to talk about that. And first it was the Victorians, and later it was in the 1920s, a time that was charged with that energy, but still at a time when in the media you weren't supposed to be talking about that. And that's how it jumped to the stage. And then in the 1930s, it jumped to the movies. And it's not a surprise that now the vampire is a teenager and, you know, a disenfranchised group of people who aren't supposed to be talking about sex, but who want to talk about it. And so we have all of the analogies, all of the rituals of the vampire transferred over in a way that we can talk about them and address them.
Jim Steinmeier is with us. His book is called Who Was Dracula? Bram Stoker's Trail of Blood. It's now out on paperback. You can join us if you have comments or questions. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West, on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Dracula, not so much about the character of the creepy and mysterious vampire, but also the story behind the book. The historian Jim Steinmeier is with us, and he admits Bram Stoker didn't write a great novel, but for some reason it has become a phenomenon, and he's with us to explain why. His book is called Who Was Dracula? Bram Stoker's Trail of Blood, and you can join us if you like. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. You know, it's interesting, in all of the things that he wrote about himself, Stoker doesn't really, you say this in the book, doesn't really mention the good stuff. He doesn't talk much about his marriage or his family, or even he doesn't say that much about the publication of Dracula. What he's most interested in, it seems like, is his relationship with Henry Irving.
He didn't write an autobiography. He wrote an autobiography of his friend, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. He wrote a two-volume tribute to Irving, which really is hagiography.
Yeah.
And in the middle of it, there's extensive sections about Stoker himself. But once again, only as it applies to Irving, only as it applies to the service of his friends. So he says almost nothing about his family. He says almost nothing about his published works, his literary aspirations, all of the things that we would find interesting today. He was the loyal soldier. He was completely the loyal soldier. And that's how he was known among the people at the end of the century who had met Henry Irving. He was the kind of dull guy with red hair and a red beard standing off at the side with a clipboard or a sheaf of notes as Henry Irving carried on and did his job. And he really played that part. He played that part up until his death. What's sad, of course, is, as I mentioned, he never lived to see the success of Dracula. He saw it only as a moderately successful novel.
Yeah. Well, his wife was able to make a decent income off of that. We'll get to that a little bit later, but it is interesting and maybe ironic that no one knows who Henry, for the most part, most of us anyway, don't know who Henry Irving is at all. It's Bram Stoker who's name we can recall.
There's a, you know, when you're writing a book like this, you find little bits of quotations and reviews and, you know, those things that make you laugh out loud. And one of them is a review of Bram Stoker's biography of Henry Irving. And it says, you know, Bram Stoker has written several novels, but clearly he will be remembered today. He will be remembered forever for his book on Henry Irving, because that is his literary contribution, which just shows how wrong, of course, someone can be at the time. And it's understandable, because Henry Irving was an enormous star.
Yeah.
And, you know, several years after he died, that's what people focused on. Oh, here's the story of Henry Irving. But, of course, they completely ignored and completely missed the obvious literary influence of Bram Stoker.
We should mention a little bit about, you write a bit about Stoker's life. Born Abraham Stoker, named after his father, in a town on the outskirts of Dublin. Third of seven kids. Comfortably middle class, you say. They were Protestant. His father had a decent civil service job. And I guess Bram follows in the footsteps, at least at first, of his father. Liked the theater, his father did. Bram liked the theater, but he worked as a clerk for the judicial system at first. So he did seem like he was just going to be this officious guy early on.
He always works in the thrall of great men. And he, I think, lives his life slightly vicariously through great men. He's the kind of soldier that a great man needs. And we see this early in his university days, from his years in Dublin, when he writes to Walt Whitman in admiration of his poetry and kind of pledges his allegiance and pledges to be his disciple for his poetry. And shortly after that, he meets Henry Irving, who comes to Dublin with a theater tour and meets him and is completely enamored with Irving and his abilities and his skills. And I think he sees that there's a partnership there in terms of providing business acumen for a man who's principally a creative, a creature of creativity. And he sees his life, I think, lived in the service of these great men. It creates difficulties because Stoker clearly has aspirations of as a serious writer and also as a playwright. And those are never realized because he's always got the job to do with Irving. Mm-hmm. And it's clearly a frustration to him.
Do we know when the idea of what would become Dracula first comes to him? Because you mentioned that by the time the book really was first published, audiences were pretty familiar with vampire stories. It seems like they were all over the place.
He must have encountered vampire stories. We know that he did in Dublin.
Yeah.
When he was at Trinity College. We know that he met Dion Boucicault, an Irish playwright there who had written a play called The Vampire. We know that he worked actually on a publication that was owned by Sheridan Le Fanu. Le Fanu had written Carmilla, which was probably the most influential vampire story before Dracula, certainly one of the most artistic. So he was steeped in this. He would have understood, to put it plainly, that vampire stories made money. He would have understood that as a man of the theater coming from Dublin. And we don't know exactly when the vampire story began. In the 1970s, there was a real literary surprise, which was his notes turning up at the Rosenbach Library in Philadelphia. And that sort of changed everything. Everyone had always assumed that Stoker's novels were written quite quickly. In fact, all of Stoker's novels were written quickly. They were usually written over vacations. And naturally, people assumed that Dracula was similarly composed over the course of 6 months or a year. And when his notes were found, we realized why Dracula is so much better a novel than any of the rest of his. And it's that he took 7 years to compose this book.
Assembled is how you describe it in the book.
Yes. It's very painstakingly assembled in a kind of meticulous way from schedules and calendars and bits and pieces and stories that are being adjusted, names that are being fixed, and places that are being adjusted from one place to another in Europe. But what's fascinating about that timeline of how he's creating it is that we can put that opposite his own life and who he knew at that time and what was happening at that time. So it was very carefully composed, and I think that it had a number of influences as this was happening.
Well, let's talk about one in particular, because I loved this part of the book when you're writing. This is 1885, and Stoker's working with Henry Irving, who's putting together this remarkable production of Goethe's Faust, and he's orchestrating this production, and it has all of these remarkable elements to it, and it's a great spectacle, and Stoker's watching all of this, and people are wondering if it's going to be a disaster, because it seems like, how's this going to come together? And then, tell the story if you would, because I think it's really great. Irving, you know, when he really puts on the costume, the thing comes alive, and it seems like that was a really powerful influence.
I think what we see in Irving's productions and his huge successes are the little embers of the Dracula character about to catch hold, about to catch flame. And I think that certainly one of these is the production of Faustus, which it's really hard to underestimate this in Victorian London. You know, Faustus was a turning point in the culture. You know, just as we would say, you know, Star Wars or you know, some really influential movie that then changes the way that people are telling those stories afterwards.
Yeah.
In many ways, it was, you know, a little tacky, a little overwrought. Certainly, there were critics who criticized it for being busy and noisy and you know, a classic kind of turned into a sensation. But it was exactly that. It was a classic that was turned into an amazing popular sensation by Irving. And the story that I talk about is how Irving staged these numbers. He did it by assembling. You have to understand he had almost unlimited resources, not necessarily in terms of money, but things were different then. But in terms of cast and crew, he could simply summon up, you know, more imps, more devils. And there was this amazing scene, the Brocken scene, which had nothing to do with the plot, strangely enough. It was interpolated right in the middle like an intermezzo in this play, which was the top of a kind of blasted mountain where Mephistopheles brings Faustus and then summons up witches and supernatural beings, hundreds of them, literally a cast of hundreds, assembling on this mountaintop dressed in these elaborate supernatural costumes. And when it was staged, and Irving, of course, as the director and the actor, you know, did it by sitting in the audience and telling all these people what to do, Stoker watched it all kind of in horror, not the obvious horror, but a producer's horror, right, wondering if any of this was going to work because it was so elaborate and it was filled with these supernatural screams and wails and it seemed to make no sense at all. And worst of all, it looked awful. It was all kind of a scene set in blues and grays and greens and, you know, looked monotonous and looked tiresome. And he quietly pulled Irving aside and he said, you know, I'm a little worried about the visual picture here. And Irving said, you haven't seen it with me. You haven't seen it with me in the middle of it. And what that was all about, of course, was the scarlet red robe of Mephistopheles, which was incidentally the first time that the devil was established wearing red.
Yeah.
And why we have that today. It's all from Henry Irving's production. And when Irving appeared, of course, as this red figure in the middle of these hundreds of demons, it was the centerpiece and it was the visual kind of gasp. And what we see in it is the first incarnation of Dracula, because at the end of it, the vision of Marguerite appears all in white with a big red gash across her neck as if she's bleeding from the neck. And that's the vision, that's the horror of the vision that they see in front of them from this mountaintop. And we see all those elements later echoed 5 years later in the story of Dracula as he starts to compose it.
Yeah. So what he's busy taking notes about these kinds of things, whether he's literally taking notes, but he's certainly taking note of these images that eventually will become, you know, reflected in the book, I guess.
Absolutely. Is it an artistic sense? Is it a subconscious sense? Is it a conscious sense? Or is it pure economics? I mean, yeah. There's a certain aspect where you look at this and you say, Stoker understood what Irving liked. He understood who Irving wanted to play, what kind of villains Irving could play very well. And I think there's an element of that as well, that he understands what will appeal to the popular culture.
Where did the name come from? This is interesting because you say he was... in the process of assembling all of this information, the name Dracula really comes at the right time. I mean, he'd been using the title had been different, but then it seems like he kind of stumbled into this. He really lucks out.
He really does. He really lucks out, and it's kind of one of the great literary red herrings, a story from the 1970s. There were two authors named McNally and Florescu who wrote a wonderful book called In Search of Dracula. And they had come across the information that that there was a Dracula.
Yeah.
Now, we all know this. We all know this from the subsequent 40 years. But there was a count from that area who was known for horrific tortures, and who was Vlad Tepes and was nicknamed Vlad Dracul, of the devil or of a dragon, is what that designation means. And so the authors, when they found this information about this 15th century count, they assumed naturally that Stoker had heard about it, that Stoker had taken the name from this terrible historical figure. Probably they figured that Augustus Vanbury had who knew about Transylvanian lore, had told him about Dracul, and that he deliberately chose this name because he knew the legend. And in a great irony, McNally and Florescu, in doing research for later books, they were the ones to find the notes of the novel in the collection in Philadelphia. And when they did, they realized that Stoker had a complete bibliography in there of every book, every source he had used to compose Dracula. And the answer is he had no idea who Vlad Dracul was. He had simply found the name. He would have found the name and he would have found the designation that it meant devil or dragon. And that's all he would have known.
Yeah.
The rest of it was kind of pure dumb luck. But it is really the perfect name because it has just enough of a connotation. We can hear the word in it that we know that it's evil. And it wasn't actually evil. As it was applied to the original count, it was meant of the dragon, and it was a kind of honorary award given him for his bravery. But that word Dracul suddenly jumps into the outline. We can see that when he scratches out the word vampire and he puts the word Dracul or Dracula afterwards. Mm. So it's the perfect kind of Middle Eastern name that summons up all of this and wraps it all up and ties a bow around it.
Jim Steinmeier is with us. His book is called Who Was Dracula? Bram Stoker's Trail of Blood. You can join us 801-585-WEST, our email address radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take another quick break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the story and Jim Steinmeier. We're talking about his book, Who Was Dracula? Bram Stoker's Trail of Blood. He's joining us from Southern California Public Radio in Pasadena. So you describe a number of the people who, of course, inspired Bram Stoker in this project. Among them, you referenced this earlier, I wanted you to talk a little bit more about Walt Whitman, who you say contributed a kind of bold carnality. What was the influence of Whitman on the, do we see that in the character of Dracula in the book?
Well, the strange thing is the character of Dracula. Dracula is very badly described in this book.
Yeah.
He appears, it's sort of famous how little he appears in the book. Mm. He's a sort of thing out there that people talk about, but he appears in very little of the book. And part of that's the way it's written, because it's epistolatory, because it's written in terms of diaries and letters. If he's not writing, of course, we don't get anything. We just get people talking about him. But one of the descriptions of Dracula that appears within the pages, a number of scholars have pointed out that the person it matches more than anyone else in terms of Stoker's writing is Walt Whitman. The kind of wild, white-haired, hair-thinning, you know, bold, kind of slightly swaggering, dangerous adventurer, this larger-than-life figure.
An obsession with death, sort of, as well?
Absolutely, yeah. Obsession with death, a kind of beautiful way of mixing death and sexuality in a kind of poetic way. There are only several quotes from Dracula, kind of long quotes from Dracula within the book, where people give accounts of what he's saying. And he speaks with a kind of poetry. He speaks with a kind of sense of honor and poetry that comes dangerously close to Whitman, in the sense that Stoker was an admirer of Whitman. He met him on two occasions when he came to the United States, and was very proud of that association, and wrote about those meetings in his book about Henry Irving.
I'm so intrigued by the influence you may see of the American West on this story. This idea of once that crucial scene we talked about takes place, there's this kind of like Wild West posse going after Dracula. Was that influenced by the American West?
Well, Stoker had written a book set in the American West, a short novel, and I think that there was a strong influence there. He certainly knew Bill Cody, Buffalo Bill, and was an admirer of that aspect of American culture. And I think, again, to people who haven't read the book, they would be surprised to find that there is an American in the book, an American cowboy named Quincy Morris, who leads the charge back to Transylvania and who is one of the people responsible for killing Dracula. And there's a kind of slightly, I think we'd look at it today and say, so slightly cockeyed Victorian sensibility about Quincy Morris, you know, the straight talking American who has a revolver and a Bowie knife, and you know how he takes justice in his own hands. There's a kind of vigilante sense of Dracula that this group of people go off to find him and kill him, and that really does feel more like a Western than any other kind of novel.
Mm. Of course, the Stoker family, they were friends with the Wilde family, Oscar Wilde's family. And you write about they weren't great friends, as you say, but Oscar Wilde had, I love this, you say, he contributed to, or potentially did anyway, his corrupting immorality. That was the influence of Oscar Wilde in all of this. Explain that.
Stoker was a good enough friend of Wilde to have been completely spooked by what was happening to Oscar Wilde at the time, which was this, of course, the famous controversy in the trial and his immorality, his homosexuality, which put him in Reading jail. And a lot has been written about that, but what's harder to find is how his friends and associates were dealing with this, which was with a great deal of difficulty. And we know that this is a problem for Stoker because he goes into the Henry Irving biography and removes Oscar Wilde's name. There is no reference of Oscar Wilde in that book. And Wilde was, of course, a huge friend of the Lyceum and literally a personal friend of all of the principals at the Lyceum. He was there at important dinners. He was there for important events. And Stoker's book revels in the name dropping. But that's a name that's been completely exorcised from the book. Wilde's controversy deeply hurt the people around him. Not because I think it was a surprise to them. I don't think that anyone in the theater, even at that time, could have been surprised by the presence of homosexuals.
Sure.
But I think that the his sort of wantonness about it surprised everyone. And there's a shocking little story in here. The day that Henry Irving, it was announced that he would be getting his knighthood, basically the most glorious day in the history of the British theater, was the same day that Oscar Wilde was found guilty in the court and was sent to jail. And that one day was both the highest and the lowest moment in the Victorian theater. And Stoker was right in the middle of those people. He was an old friend of Wilde's, mm-hmm. and he was the associate of Henry Irving's. So he was dealing with all of that. And we can see that he dealt with it with a great deal of embarrassment. But Wilde was understood as a kind of corrupting influence, as someone who had to be controlled and who had corrupted a generation of people around him. And that was understood in the press, writing about his stories even before the trial. And I think that we see this being played out in the story of Dracula, mm-hmm. not in an accusatory way. It's very hard to read necessarily how Stoker is passing any judgment on this or whether he is. But he's using those elements of popular culture, to describe the story of a vampire. And I think to a very strong and an effective way.
I don't want to give too much away in this story, at least the part about Jack the Ripper. Tell us enough about that part, though, to intrigue us.
It's really possible that Stoker had dinner with Jack the Ripper. It's very possible the way to say that is, he almost certainly knew and was introduced to one of the leading suspects in the case. And that was a man named Francis Tumulty, who was an American. And he would have been intrigued by him because he was an American. He also would have been intrigued by him because he was an old friend of Bram Stoker's, named Hall Caine. Hall Caine was a Victorian novelist. And for those of you who like trivia, Dracula is dedicated to Hami Beg. You might remember that if you've read it. He dedicates the book to Hami Beg. Hami Beg is a little term of endearment for Hall Caine. He dedicated Dracula to Hall Caine. And Hall Caine is the man who would have introduced him to Francis Tumulty, this rather strange American who ended up being one of the suspects in the Jack the Ripper case. Was he Jack the Ripper? Well, there's no way of telling.
Sure.
But Stoker would have understood that he was a suspect because he jumped bail in the UK and went back to the United States and was being written about in the papers at a time when Stoker was later over in America with Henry Irving. So I think Stoker would have understood that he had a near brush with Jack the Ripper.
Mm.
And he later wrote in an introduction to one of the editions of the novel that the book was influenced by the Jack the Ripper case. So I think that's a real clue.
Do you think that we would be talking about this now if it weren't for the stage version, the play version of Dracula, at least the one that was started by Hamilton Dean?
Yeah. I think the answer to that is no, we wouldn't be talking about it.
Yeah.
It would be a charming Victorian novel that would bubble up every couple of years and someone would say, "Oh, we should read that." But the fact that it's a cultural icon is completely the work of the 1920s and this play that first went to the West End and then went to Broadway and then later was the inspiration for Bela Lugosi and every other incarnation of it.
What did Florence Stoker, Bram Stoker's wife, think about it? I mean, you mentioned in the book, she went to that first a production of it. This was in Valentine's Day of 1927 at the Little Theater at the West End of London.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty dreadful in the sense that it was, as you describe it, and you know, critics tore it apart. Bad acting, stupid lines, got terrible reviews, but of course, it made a lot of money.
Dracula was renowned for many, many years as being the play that couldn't lose money. That when a theater company was in trouble, you dragged out Dracula and you put money in the cash box and then you went on to the other productions. Florence Stoker was quite grand. The old vampire took care of her in her widowhood.
Right.
And she licensed this production. It was unquestionably a real concession. Dracula is a play that's acted out, you know, by characters in evening wear standing around a sofa,
yeah,
leaning over someone, you know, locking French doors and wondering what's happening.
Yeah.
It was a sort of famous production in which almost nothing happened. The British production is incredibly stagey. It was fixed, quote unquote, when it came to the United States. It was rewritten with another author. And it was certainly better when it came to the United States. But it was once again a sort of famous production for very little happening. You know, drawing rooms, bedrooms, French doors, mm-hmm, maids, butlers, and a lot of talk about that mysterious man next door.
Right. Yeah, I do have to say I love the little gimmicks that all of the productions seem to throw in. One of them, and I can't remember if this was in the British version or the American version, they would post a nurse nearby to say, in case anyone faints. Like, there seems like there were a lot of gimmicks just to scare the hell out of people in the audience.
There was a lot of that in the theater at the day, and Dracula was not above any of that.
Right.
Saying to people, don't worry, if you faint, you know, you'll be taken care of. There was a lot of expectation built up for it.
Right.
And I don't know if it really paid off, but what is interesting about it, I think culturally, what was really significant about the play was it came out of an era in the 20s when there were a lot of supernatural mysteries. But they always had explanations.
Hmm.
Plays like The Cat and the Canary and The Bat were huge successes. But at the end of it, they always unmasked the villain.
Right.
And they always said, and he was the one who was posing as the monster. And Dracula was the first play where there was no explanation. He really was a vampire. And I think that was the thing that first shocked people seeing it on stage, was that sort of thing at the end where you never got an explanation of it. And it changed the way everybody started looking at those stories on stage.
This is, of course, in the American version is where we first encounter Bela Lugosi, who was,
right,
I didn't realize this, he was hired when the first actor wanted to be paid too much.
Bela Lugosi, unfortunately, you know, the good and the bad, you know, was completely typecast in that role. He barely spoke English at the time he was learning Dracula. He learned the part phonetically.
Wow.
Which might explain the kind of strange cadence and the way he,
right,
he did the role. And then he worked very hard to get the Hollywood role and almost didn't get it because he was thought of as a kind of two-bit Broadway actor. And then finally, in a kind of cost-cutting, Universal hired him to play the role on stage. And of course, that was what cemented his fame. But it's interesting. It's interesting to me to note that we keep reinventing Dracula every,
yeah,
generation. And if you look at it, Dracula in the 1920s is nothing like Stoker's Dracula.
Right.
What he is a kind of zombie version of Rudolph Valentino, You know, the patent leather hair, the exotic man from another country who has come to steal our women. And it's interesting that Valentino had died just the year before in 1926, before the show opened. So Lugosi really was an incarnation of the zombie Valentino,
yeah,
who had come back in this kind of exotic role to play Dracula. And it's a role that we get to reinvent over and over and over again for every successive generation.
Well, and these days, they're teenagers, as you said before.
Right. Right, and it's perfect for teenagers. You know, it's the people who are disaffected, who don't have a vote, who don't have any influence, but they get to live their lives in this kind of supernatural, operatic way.
You know, you were pointing out Dracula really only appears in about 60 pages or so of the nearly 400 in the novel. Doesn't make very many speeches, as you pointed out. Doesn't really share many insights or, you know, talk much about his own motivations. But you say that this idea of leaving a lot of this character of Dracula kind of blank may have been Bram Stoker's greatest achievement. Got about a minute left. Explain what you mean by that. The reader has to fill in the details, I guess, right?
We're always filling in the details to Dracula. The novel swirls around him without defining him, and we start putting those pieces together in our mind. And what's happened is that every generation we reinvent Dracula again and again and again. I don't know whether that's deliberate on Stoker's part. I don't know if it was an accidental bit of good fortune. But Dracula is a hole in the middle of this story. And every time we tell the story, we get to reinvent Dracula in a way that will scare us. And I think that's always been the secret of this novel and the secret of that character. And it will keep happening. We see it happening again in the Twilight series and then before that in the Lestat series and Anne Rice's books. It happens over and over and over again. The rules keep getting applied, and there's a new Dracula that comes out of the mists to terrify us.
Jim Steinmeier, historian and designer of illusions. He's also the author of the book, Who Was Dracula? Bram Stoker's Trail of Blood. He joined us from Southern California Public Radio in Pasadena. Jim Steinmeier, thank you very much for the time.
Thanks, Doug. It was a pleasure.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Thanks to Susan Anderson and to Michael Shea. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. The show produced by Benjamin Bombard, Andy Linklark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.